Good day, boys and girls, moms and dads, and children of all ages. Ships at sea and ships on the rocks and ships in calm water. Everybody out there, we've got another episode of a fishing show.
We need a name for this thing.
I used to call it Radio Fishing. I called it Wishing I Was Fishing. I've called it The Fishing Zone. It's Fish and Franks, and my co-host today, as me being Fish and Frank, my co-host today is Captain Josh Olive. And, you know, what we're going to do is kind of spend a minute getting, there's a lot of questions in the fishing business, and the first question is, how did we get started? And believe it or not, Josh and I are in similar circumstances on how we ended up here. Both of us were kind of accidental on purpose.
I like that, yeah. Fished, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, I fished most of my life, and but I would go out with a piece of bait and throw it, catch a fish, and, you know, flay one out every once in a while, eat it. And, you know, but fishing to me was a kind of a mild form of recreation, just a way to get away for a little while and enjoy myself. But I was, you know, working, playing music, you know, doing jobs, doing all this other kind of stuff. And fishing was a nice side trip in my life, but it wasn't a very important part of it. It was just, you know, something I enjoyed every once in a while. And I think you were kind of along the same lines. I think when we were young, we both did a lot of fishing and then kind of got out of it, and work and life and everything intervened. And all of a sudden, one day, my dad has a bait shop. And my dad, being who he is, eventually ended up needing somebody who was willing to work with him.
Very short list, I'm sure.
So, I mean, I love my dad, but let's face it, our dads are our dads, our kids are our kids. You know, you want to be at least a little realistic about it. And I found, for me, it was the people in the store, asking questions, finding the answers for them, working with them, showing rods, lifting weights, doing all this stuff. It was a lot of fun. And the people were amazing. And I actually ended up in this job becoming Fish and Frank, and later doing tournaments and charters and all this other kind of stuff, based on my interaction with the customers. That was my accidental. My dad having the bait shop, me coming in to help out, and then meeting the people and the customers, that's what got me into the business, and that's what kept me in the business. And for you, how did you get started into this?
Well, for me, when I was a kid, I grew up out in rural DeSoto County on a 180-acre cattle ranch. So I spent hours and hours and hours outside. And on that ranch, there's about a 6-acre lake, and there's also a creek that runs through it on two sides. So all kinds of different fishing opportunities for me, all kinds of snakes and tortoises.
I was
going to
say,
were
you like me as a kid? We had the creek behind the house. We had a little that ran into a little bit bigger. I wouldn't say it was a river, but a little bit bigger one. But it was as much about the exploring, turning over rocks, catching all the stuff, as it was the fishing.
Oh, absolutely. Maybe, I mean, depending on the day, sometimes a lot more so. But I was always out there. I'd usually have...
Did you build the little forts, too? I mean, out of sticks, and we built, like, forts in the side of a bank on the river. And we actually had rocks that we put on the floor and, you know, sticks and stuff for walls and ceiling.
You've been outside here in Florida, right? You've seen how few rocks there are in any of those natural areas.
That's true. I mean,
kind of a shortage of building materials.
I was way up in the Midwest. You know, that was up in Illinois, actually.
What we did, actually, was we would build forts, but the forts were much simpler. All you needed was a blanket and some palmettos.
Yeah.
That's it. The palmettos are already growing. Just take your blanket, throw it across it, instant fort. So simple. But... You know, I did all that stuff, and one of my favorite things to do once I realized you could was I would catch little fish in a dip net for bait, and I would take them over to the lake, and I would trade them in for some bigger fish, which usually were not big fish. They were, you know, palm-sized bluegills, and then take those and trade those in for the bass that lived out there, because we never killed a bass out of that lake. We released every one we caught, and so there were good numbers of good-sized bass. Not huge, but 6-8 pound fish were pretty plentiful.
Really nice. Now, you know, when you actually got into this business kind of by accident. You were working for the newspaper, and you're going along, you've got your job, you started out, and you've literally worked your way up from the very bottom of the ranks all the way into publisher. But right. Becoming the publisher was almost accidental for you.
Well, getting into Waterline was almost accidental. When I worked at the newspaper, I was in a department they call the pre-press department, which basically is preparing the plates to go on the press to print a newspaper. And the pre-press department was shrinking and shrinking and shrinking because it's getting mechanically taken over. Machines do the work. So eventually it got to the point where they didn't need the people to do it anymore. And I said, I can't stay in this department anymore. There's going to be nobody left but me. So I moved out to the copy desk, which is where they build the pages. And when I got there, it wasn't more than a couple weeks before the sports guys said, you know what? We're sick and tired of putting together this stupid Waterline thing. We need to find somebody who is more interested in the outdoors and in boating and fishing. And they said, hey, wait a minute. That guy over there, I think Josh fishes. So we could get him to do Waterline. And I said, yeah, sure, I can do Waterline. Because at that point, it was kind of crappy. You know, it needed some design work. It didn't look very good. It was boring. And I said, sure, I can do something with that. And so I started doing something with that.
You know, many things about the Waterline when it was going through, there was, what, 6 publishers before you, each one lasting a few months or something like that?
Well, there was actually never a publisher before me. We had editors before me. But the publisher title, they never gave that to anybody. And the reason that I asked for it was because I'd built the thing up from what it was, which was something that, you know, was a piece of junk that they were almost going to scrap.
You know, I would not get involved with it for several years because it was kind of embarrassing. The guys who were doing the editing and stuff were very biased from one thing or another, and it just wasn't a good magazine to get around and get behind. You get a lot of grief as the new publisher because you go both sides of all the issues, and that in today's world, that's a tough place to be, is in the middle.
It's really tough. And you know, I was actually talking about this with my wife yesterday, and she was talking about, you know, the crazy people out there on both sides, on the liberal side and on the Republican or the conservative side. We should
call them Democrats and Republicans. Well, we do, but
there's all kinds of crazy people everywhere. And I said, yeah, and she said, but she thinks there's more crazy conservatives. And I said, oh no, there's an equal number of crazy conservatives and crazy liberals. And the reason that I see it that way is because I'm in the middle of the bell curve. You know, it's not that I'm not crazy. Everybody's crazy. I have my own specific crazies, just like
you
do. You
have your own brand of crazy. That's there is no doubt about that. The one thing that comes back, and I try to look for the middle solution myself, and the one thing I reject is the extreme on one side and the extreme on the other, because I've never found the truth to be all the way to the right or all the way to the left. All the way to the eco nut, all the way to the kill everything guy. The truth is 99%, or at least to me, the best option is usually somewhere in the middle.
Almost always.
And I get a lot of grief because of my ecological. My view is the fish enjoy us catching and releasing as much as we enjoy catching and releasing the fish. And I absolutely believe it's true. And there's been no evidence to the contrary and possible evidence to support my theory. And I just, you know, I think these people who think, you know, if you're going to catch and release a fish, it's, you know, you're, I don't know, whatever you're doing to this animal. But I think a fish leads a pretty boring life. To me, you know,
okay.
Laying around.
I can see your argument.
Sleeping, eating, you know, fornicating. That's pretty much the, you know, trying not to get killed. That's the biggest thing a fish actually has to do is try not to be killed by another fish.
Job number one right there.
Job number one, stay alive. And, you know, I think it adds a little excitement to the day. I have caught and personally seen on my boat where I've had 20 plus snook lined up underneath it after catch and releasing these fish where they just literally left my hand, swam under the boat, and laid out, just relaxed. And so that tells me they had fun, didn't bother them, they're back in the water, and they're literally laying there where I can see them and they can see me. So if this was all that detrimental and this was horrible to them, why are they just hanging out?
Well, I think it kind of confuses their systems a little bit, because normally when something gets caught by a predator, it either gets eaten or it struggles and it escapes. And if you watch animals that struggle and escape, they tend to go back to their normal lives as quickly as they possibly can. Like, you'll see, if you watch this kind of stuff in nature, a frog that almost gets eaten by a garter snake, but the garter snake is not able to quite get his jaws on him, and he misses him, and the frog escapes. And it's not a minute later that frog might grab another frog and start mating with it, because that's just what they do. They just get on with life. I think your snook are just getting on with life, and your boat provides a very nice shade.
Yeah, well, but that's what I'm saying. I think they just relax. Hey, that was cool. Okay. You know, I'm good. And I have seen zero evidence to the contrary. So, anyway, I can have my beliefs just like everybody else does.
So, and you can even have your crazy beliefs just like everybody else does.
And
we're all entitled to them. We all have them.
And this is, I think, the big reason that you and I ended up hosting a show together. You got into this. We kind of did it by default. All of a sudden, there we were. It wasn't
a planned aspect.
I didn't grow up thinking, okay, I'm going to be in a bait shop, I'm going to do fishing talks, I'm going to be a guide, I'm going to be a tournament fisherman, I'm going to do all this stuff. It just kind of organically developed.
You asked me to come work here in the shop to help you out for a tent sale. And I said, you know what, I'll go help Frank out for the tent sale, because you want me to take some photos. You said, you don't have to really deal with the public, just take some photos and, you know, do that kind of stuff, and you can hide behind your camera and all that. I was like, okay, I can do that. I can hide behind the camera, because I never worked in a job where you have to deal with the public all the time. Even as a magazine publisher, you don't deal with the public per se. You may get phone calls or emails,
Josh,
but you don't
have to
deal with
the night
person.
Shift. You didn't deal with anybody but maybe a radio that you could yell at if you heard the wrong thing on
That's kind of what I was saying. So
I'm sorry. You know, you weren't out in the world too much, and to be thrown into this place,
it was something else. And you know, I didn't have a lot of fun with it at first, and then it was kind of like what you said, where you start listening to the customers and you start getting the questions from them and you start helping people figure stuff out. And that's when I rediscovered the joy that I had for teaching, because it's one of the things that I might have considered going into had I actually gone to school. I mean, I was planning to be a fisheries research biologist, but I also had a thought for maybe I could be a teacher. Because I've always enjoyed that. I've always enjoyed learning things and then sharing the things that I've learned. And being able to do that here in the shop kind of tickled that, reminding me, hey, remember how much fun it is to teach people something? Remember how much fun it is to tell somebody something and get some feedback from them later that, hey, that thing that you suggested where I go and I do this thing, it worked really, really well, and here's the photos of the fish. It's like, yeah, I like that.
It's the one thing I look for here when we bring somebody on board here. One out of 50 people make it. And when you see the group we've got here, you wonder, really, these guys
can't
guys
even imagine
it.
The washouts.
But, whoa. It's the weird part about it is that's what you look for. What I watch for, I try to make there's some kind of bonus or something special when it happens. The first time somebody actually goes through on their own, interacts with a customer, shows them the stuff, you know, teaches them to tie a knot, gives them the right lure, shows them the place to go, and they come back with these amazing stories. Because basically, that's the premise Fish and Franks is built on. Helping somebody really get that great experience, you know, so that, and you literally can affect lives.
Yeah, and it's cool shop. Because you give them the confidence to go out there and succeed. And in a way, that's your victory too. When they go out and they have a good day on the water, But you know that they wouldn't have had as good a day on the water if you hadn't showed them a couple of things that made their day that much better. You know, it's much more enriching and fulfilling than I would have thought it was.
And that goes to any job. If you're out there and you're working in a convenience store, you're working at a factory, you're working anywhere, what you do with your job makes all the difference in the world. How you perceive your job. And I try and remind people, do what you like for a living and do what you love for a hobby. And that usually seems to be the best. All of us like fishing and we enjoy it, but we enjoy the customers more. And I don't know. But anyway, I just wanted to give you guys an idea that Josh and I actually, and I think one of the reasons we're friends now, is we got into the business, literally both of us by default, and it was the interaction with the people that actually put us where we are. And so in the realm of teaching, Josh, you've been getting the newspaper ready, the waterline ready for publication. What's the number one fish people are talking about?
Well, right now, with the water warming up, everybody's getting excited about the mackerel coming in. And mackerel brings the kingfish along, brings the little tunny or bonita along, brings the blackfin tuna along, and we're starting to see a couple of cobia, too.
They also bring the sharks. They also bring...
Right. Big predators coming in right behind them, and the tarpon are right behind those. So it's a whole list of things that people are getting excited for, but it kind of starts with the Spanish mackerel for a lot of people because that's the first one that they'll see. When they start catching a few Spanish, they get excited because it's like, oh, okay, I know what's coming. This is just the leading edge of what's about to happen, what's about to explode in our waters.
And Spanish mackerel are just a gorgeous fish. I mean, beautiful colors, huge teeth, the forked tail, they're fast. They really kind of go almost everywhere. They're all up and down the Atlantic, all through Florida. You can find them in a lot of states have them right out in very close to them. So if you're looking at mackerel, not only is it a gorgeous fish, it's a lot of fun to catch. Now, I would say two basic ways of catching them, accidental and on purpose, no. Literally trolling or still fishing. Now, still fishing can incorporate trolling or, you know, just having the boat stationary and casting at them. Which is your favorite method? Do you like to go trolling or do you like to go out and go casting?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, I like to do those. Yes, I like to do both of those things. Let me tell you about the first Spanish mackerel that I caught. And this is one of the things that made me really like this species was looking back on this experience and realizing what a democratic fish a Spanish mackerel is. And I mean a fish of the people, not a fish of the Democratic Party. Don't paint me with that brush.
Okay.
The first Spanish mackerel I caught.
I'm going to go through. This is a nonpartisan fish. We want to make sure everybody understands. Good God. Okay. So for your nonpartisan fish, what about your first Spanish mackerel?
I was fishing out at El Jabin with my dad, and it was maybe the first, I don't know, maybe probably one of the first 10 trips that I had taken to saltwater fishing. And we were fishing with shrimp, fishing on a little sinker rig, fishing down close to the bottom. We were catching mangrove snapper. I'd caught a sheep's head, which was a lot of fun because I saw his teeth and he was really cool. And I had a float in my tackle box. And I said, Dad, what happens if I put a float out there and I let the water carry it away? And he said, well, I don't know. Try it. See what happens. So I put it out there, put a whole shrimp on, hooked right through the middle of the back because I didn't know how to hook the stupid things. Put it out there with the float, let it drift out towards the bridge, and a Spanish mackerel about 16 inches long came up and ate it. And I said, that is the prettiest fish I've ever seen. He was gorgeous.
Now, I tell people that if you really want to do good on Spanish mackerel, use the same techniques. I do a lot of the same techniques as I do for sea trout. I like popping corks to get their attention. I suspend the bait off of corks because, to me, I think mackerel are more middle to upper water column. And so if you're in 10 feet of water from 5 feet to the surface, if you're out in the Gulf, it's usually upper water column within 10 feet of the surface where the Spanish mackerels seem to hang out. They don't really go down deep. Even though they do, that's not where I primarily catch them.
Well, it's not where they're usually feeding, because most of the time Spanish mackerel are feeding on little bait fish, schooling bait fish, and those tend to stay closer towards the surface of the water, and especially if they're being chased by a predator, one of the first things that they'll usually do is head right to the top, which to me doesn't sound like a bad well, it sounds like a terrible plan, actually. It sounds like a horrible, horrible plan, because where are you going to
really
go?
It's really dumb, yeah. You know, I mean, it's the same thing as a white bait. The reason they work good for bait, the greenbacks and stuff, is because they try to go to the surface and run away from a predator. He's bigger, stronger, and faster. I don't know which supreme deity gave bait fish this advice. Okay, you know, you're going to be eaten. Let's run up. You know, let's not go to the bottom and hide around a rock.
It was probably the god of mackerel that gave them that idea.
The god of mackerel?
Yeah.
I would say
he's on the mackerel side.
I would say that, yeah, but why do mackerel do the same thing? The god of billfish. The one's been teaching the other one these dumb tricks so that they all have a problem.
And of course, it was all started by the god of birds, because they wanted to have a steady supply for the terns and seagulls that can't dive for themselves.
Gotcha. All right. So this is the spaghetti god of fish. Okay. Anyway, Spanish mackerel, their primary food, believe it or not, is shrimp and squid. They love the anchovies and stuff. It's third on their list. Shrimp, squid, and then the anchovies and stuff. These are all primary baits. I was always surprised to find that squid was so high up on their list.
Well, and we don't have a lot of squid in our harbor, for sure. We have some squid out in the Gulf of Mexico, but they probably aren't eating quite as much squid here in our nearshore waters as they would be in other places. They certainly will eat squid, but if you catch Spanish mackerel and examine their stomach contents, the number one thing that I find, anyway, here in our area, is very tiny bait fish. And a lot of it is bay anchovies, which most people will call a glass minnow. Generally, they're 2 inches long or less. It's rare to find, you know, something like a larger white bait or thread herring in their stomachs. And when you do, usually there's a hook mark in it.
Okay. Okay. Kind of talking about Spanish mackerel, you know, as with a lot of fish, the females get bigger and live longer. They live up to 11 years, get up to about 11 pounds. Males, not quite as big, but they're actually able to make babies looking at around a year old, about 14 inches long. They're kind of sexually mature. And, you know, the good part about it is, like any other critter, when they're young, they're dumb. So let's talk about how to fool these goofy little mackerel, one of the best looking fish out there, into biting. I'm going to start off with a Clark squid spoon. Did you pick one of those?
No, not that one specifically.
Okay, the Clark squid spoon, the double aught with a water fillable casting bubble. Now, the double aught squid spoon is one of the aught and the double aught to me are the two best spoons ever for mackerel. As you get bigger into the twos, threes, fours, they're great for trolling for kings, and you know, you can even troll these. Their squid spoons are actually trolling spoons. But in order to cast it, I use a water fillable casting bobber. I put it on the leader above where my squid is. Unlike what I do with some of them, this I put above the knot. I put the casting bubble on, a bead, tie my knot, or put a swivel on there, and then put the spoon out 2 to 2.5 feet away from it.
What's your weight on that little dinky thing if you don't have a casting bubble on it?
I would say a 16th of an ounce or a 32nd of an ounce.
So a little teeny tiny spoon. It's almost like trying to cast a bare hook.
Yeah.
Except it's got wind resistance.
Yeah, there's no way to really successfully cast it without additional weights. And if you put a sinker on, it goes down too deep. So I use the water fillable casting bubble because it doesn't float or sink. It's just nothing in the water, heavy in the air, nothing in the water, but that allows me great distance. Originally started doing that walking the beaches out at Boca Grande, Nokomis, down by Sanibel, so I could get that distance. That heavy casting bubble allowed me to get out where the Spanish mackerel were, which is usually just like 30 to 60 feet off of the beach.
Just a little bit farther than you can cast is where the Spanish mackerel usually are.
Right.
And you get to watch them out there, and they're skyrocketing through the bait, and you cast and cast and cast, and you can't quite reach them.
So by putting the water bubble on there, it's very heavy in the air. It gave me another 20, 30 feet of cast, so I was casting 60 to 90 feet instead of 30 to 60.
Now, in this case, it's really important with that water bubble that you fill it all the way up. You do not want a shiny bubble of air to be there for those fish to hit at, because they will.
And it will keep it up too much towards the surface. I want it to go neutral, so no air bubbles in your thing. What was your Spanish mackerel pick?
Well, I've got a couple of them here, but the one that I'm going to start out with is a gotcha lure. And gotchas are a little bit on the large side. This one is a 1 ounce. It's a little bit bigger than the baits that they usually eat, but you can coax a good reaction strike with a gotcha because it's got a cool erratic action in the water, even if you're just reeling it straight in. And I want to make that point that when you're fishing for Spanish mackerel, you know, most of the time when we fish for whatever species it is, we often recommend some kind of a jerking, pausing type of retrieve. And if you're doing that with Spanish mackerel, there's a real good chance that you're going to get bit off, because Spanish mackerel have a tendency to go for the head of the bait if it's falling. If it's running away, they go for the tail so they can clip the tail end off.
I will tell you, I lose... out of all the lures I've ever used for Spanish mackerel, I get more fish before I lose it on a gotcha than ever else. It originally started its life as a head and jerk jigger. And the head and jerk jigger was made for the northern market. It was a walleye lure amongst other fish, but it was for deep water vertical jigging. And you would cast it out and let it go down towards the bottom, and it worked great in ice fishing holes. It would work off a boat. It wasn't until somebody who didn't know any better came down to Florida, started casting it and jigging it back, that people found out it was awesome on Spanish mackerel. The head and jerk jigger was then bought out by another company and relabeled Gotcha. And so this lure is very, very old. It's been around for many decades and lived under several different names, was made for one thing and ended up being for another. My number one lure for Spanish mackerel is the gotcha plugs.
And it, regardless of its age, it's still a killer bait. Now, the one that I'm holding in my hand has the single hook on the tail end, and it comes with a treble hook on the front. But the first thing I'm going to do when I take this out of the package is clip that treble hook off.
I don't. I just pinch the barbs.
Well, that's another option.
Yeah, I like having the treble hooks on my lures because of the weight, the balance, and the rudder activity. It gives me more of the correct action the lure was designed for without having to deal with the detriments of the extra treble hook. So, you know,
I were going to clip it, I would do more than just pinch the barbs down. I would actually clip the points of the hooks off to make it so that it doesn't have a round bend anymore. But, you know, everybody's got their own methods for it. I don't want anything hooked on that front hook.
Oh, you don't want anything hooked on it. Okay.
No, I don't want to have to get it off. With Spanish mackerel, I really don't like treble hooks at all. I don't like having to deal with Spanish mackerel teeth and treble hooks at the same time. I've seen too many people who just don't pay attention for a split second because they're doing something else while they're in the middle of unhooking a mackerel and end up bleeding, either from the fish or from their own hook.
Well, I don't mind getting stuck by the point of a hook. That to me is a minor injury as long as there's no barb on it. I mean, it, to me, that's very minor. Okay, the hook goes in, you pull it back out. If you got a barb on there, it's more of a possible major problem. But without a barb, I don't have any misgivings about getting stuck by them. To me, it's a very minor injury that I don't really care about.
So you're calling me a sissy?
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, that's cool. You know, I mean, that's, I can deal.
Sorry. I go and, you know, by proof of the pudding, but I do bend the, or flatten the barbs on the front treble hook, but I don't on the back when I'm throwing a rattle trap for Spanish mackerel. A rattle trap allows me to stay deep, make a lot of noise, and medium shallow, you know, I can run it medium or deep, allows me to do that, anything except very close to the surface. And especially trolling in the Gulf, if I'm trolling for Spanish mackerel, I have a rattle trap on more as a teaser than as a bait. I find my other lures get hit a lot more when I have the rattle trap on than when I don't. And that rattle trap catches the fish and also attracts them to my other lures really, really well.
I could completely see that because there's a lot going on. You've got the rattle, obviously. You're picking a brightly, you know, metallic finished bait, so it's going to have a lot of flash, and that thing wiggles like crazy, so you're going to be casting flash all over the place with it. And if you want to fish it a little bit shallower, that floating rattle trap is killer too.
Yeah, so you can do a lot of things with a rattle trap. They're made right in Louisiana. They're awesome company, All American, the whole bit's nice American lure. So, you know, keeping it with that whole made in the USA. No, I'm not partisan. Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Well, made in the USA, that's all right to be partisan about.
I am really pro that. Like Dexter Russell Knives, almost 150-year-old American knife company, will be at the tent sale this year. They're awesome people. Carl's amazing. I forget if he's the president or the vice president, but you're going to meet all those folks. Nice American-made company. All right, go ahead.
All right, I've got a Lure Jensen Crippled Herring here. And the first time I played with this bait, I was not impressed with it at all. I thought, this thing is just, it's ridiculous. It doesn't track right in the water. It doesn't do what I want it to do. But you know what? I'm going to take it out. I'm going to fish with it just in case. And you know what? The fish do not give a crap about my opinion on this thing, and they love it.
I put the single hook on, not the treble hook. I use them with the single all the time. I love them. It's a lead spoon is what it is. It's a piece of lead pounded flat, painted to look something like a fish, and it really works.
Now, the one thing I will tell you is a ball bearing swivel is your friend with this lure. It tumbles, it goes all over the place, it sends out a lot of light while it's flashing along. And this particular one, which is I don't know what size this is, but it's a 3/4 ounce. This is about the size of the little glass minnows that those mackerel are going crazy for out there. And to get a 3/4 ounce weight now, in that little size,
that Lure Jensen Crippled Herring is what that is, right?
Yes.
Okay, the Lure Jensen Crippled Herring has an amazing feature because it's basically made out of lead, to be much, much smaller and at the same time very heavy. And that's what you're looking for when I'm in the Gulf of Mexico or in the harbor. Fish are feeding on bay anchovies, glass minnows. If you've got a big spoon that's 2-3 inches, you know, 3-4 inches long, they're not going to hit that. If you've got that little tiny bait that matches the hatch of the bay anchovies, glass minnows, you are 10 times more likely to hook up. And that's where that crippled herring just shines.
It does shine for sure. The one thing I really like about this is that it comes with a nice big hook on it. So when you do hook into the occasional kingfish that's going to hit it anyway, because that's just what happens, you're not dealing with the little teeny tiny hooks that you get with a lot of the small spoons, which you got to switch out, because I don't want to try catching a kingfish on, you know, a little number 8 treble hook. Ridiculous. Right.
The great thing is it comes with a single hook and a treble hook.
Yep.
So you can decide which one you want to fish with. You don't have to pick one or the other or buy anything special. It's all right there in the package.
You can be already a sissy like me and use the single hook, or you can be a manly man like Frank and use the treble and pinch the barbs down and get stuck.
I literally use the single because it's a better hookup rate.
But you take the treble hook and pinch the barbs down and stick it into your fingers just for fun, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But only on a lure that has 2 treble hooks or more. You know, the single hooks, I don't. All right. One of the things that we do have in Southwest Florida, usually in the springtime, coming up any time now, is a lot of tiny squid. These squid are between 2 and 4 inches long, averaging 3. Okay, from the nose all the way to the back.
That was some quick math, Frank. That was really good.
And I mean, they're about the size of your thumb. I mean, without the, you know, tentacle part.
Would you call it a squidling or a squidlet?
Squidlet.
Squidlet.
Yes, I would. A little tiny squidlet. But I mean, basically, they're no bigger than your, maybe the first two things, your middle finger, a big one is about as big as your thumb. But I catch them in the cast nets out in the Gulf. They get hooked up on the lines and stuff, and this is going to come into play almost at any moment. And then finding out that Spanish mackerel, their second favorite food is squid, you've got to look at the Strike King. It's I don't know. It's called, it's an Ultimate Soft Plastic tube bait, and they're the Pro Model tubes, but the one I like is, it's kind of a white, it's got black specks on it, and it has extra red in the skirts. Red is kind of the blood color. I think most creatures see red pretty good outside of deer and dogs, but
I would imagine fish. That they would. But, you know, the thing about a squid is that much like you get the flashes of color off of a billfish or a Spanish mackerel when you're catching it, squid will give off those same kind of iridescent flashes where the color changes a lot when they're being pursued by predators. It's part of their flight response to give off those weird colors to kind of hope that it confuses the predator that's chasing them.
Or it could be to tell the other squid around, because they do talk to each other, that I'm in trouble, help me. And the other ones are like, no, I'm sorry, you're on your own, bud. You know, sorry, but I can't, you know, I'm a 2.5-inch long squid. I cannot stop that 14-pound bonita from eating you. You know, you're on your own here, bud.
Yep. Well, whatever the reason, however you interpret it, it gives you a lot of latitude in color and what you can do with those types of baits when you're trying to imitate a squid. Don't assume just because the color is too bright and flashy in the package that, you know, a squid, oh, well, I see frozen squid all the time. They're kind of this dull pink color. That's not what a live squid looks like.
No. Now, the one thing is, you trying to find the right jig head, luckily Strike King makes a good one. It's the Redfish Magic Flats jig head. It actually fits, when you take the tube bait, hold it upside down with the round part towards the floor and the skirt up, and sort the skirt out so you can see the hole in there. The tube bait is hollow. When you take the jig head and push it all the way in, you got to kind of work it. It's like getting reverse of getting toothpaste out of a tube. You're trying to get it worked, that jig head, all the way up into the front. Then simply press on both sides of the eye and it will pop right through the tube bait. Now you have something that actually looks just like a squid. Trick is having that long enough hook to get out where the hook's in, where the tentacles would be on it. Makes an amazing looking jig. And work it kind of like darting jigging action, going through the water, long cast out, and then jigging it back to you. Because squid, they want to move more laterally in the water, not quite as much up and down. So I'm bringing it back more laterally, not with a lot of jigging action, more of a darting action.
Look, we rate this show PG. For those of you who would like to hear the R-rated version, just go back and rewind it a little bit and re-listen to Frank's description of how you rig this bait. And listen for all the double entendre, because I counted 8, and I didn't respond to a single one.
I was really happy about that, too.
Moving onward.
I was really going back and forth with, how do I always explain this stuff? Hello in there. All right.
I've got a half-inch Spro bucktail jig.
I'm glad you're Sproing.
And this one is the white one. The white one I like. It's got, it looks kind of like a bait fish, but it goes kind of to your squid idea, too. Because if you look at the outline of this thing, it's kind of got a head, and it's kind of got a tentacly part, kind of like a squid kind of does.
The
sort
mylar
of a
bits
bit.
In it, and it's got, with the bright lights.
Right, like a little bit of flashing green, up. Like yeah. Squid lighting up. Now, the one thing I will do with this, because I want it to present a little bit smaller outline, is I'll cut off the last, let's say, inch and a half or so worth of the trailer on it. It's just too long for me, for what I'm going to look for. Now, some people will keep it the way it is, and I see you looking at it like, why are you going to cut that? But
no,
I'm trying to imitate multiple things.
What I would probably do is just thin it a little bit. I would try and separate the mylar from the bucktail and thin some of the bucktail around, so you have, I guess, like a mullet haircut where it's long in the center and then short around the edges, but try and leave as much of the long mylar on it as possible. The longer those mylar threads, the more light refraction you're going to get.
You have fun doing that. I'm just going to chop it.
Turn it upside down.
No. Not again.
Hold that hair out.
We're done. But again, another lure that you can cast, because it's heavy enough to cast it, or you can troll it. And a lot of people don't like to troll with a bucktail jig because they think, well, you're not getting the right action out of it. Remember, you don't want to be hopping these things along for the mackerel. You just want a nice, steady, straight, keep it going the same speed retrieve so that the mackerel hits it at the tail and tries to cut it off and stop it from swimming.
right. Now, Spanish mackerel, Ciro mackerel, and king mackerel are very, very similar in appearance.
Very. Especially when they're young.
And the lateral line is kind of the cue. And two of them, the lateral line's unbelievably similar, but the third one has a different lateral line. Okay, Mr. Josh Olive, the fish coach, Captain Josh, the publisher of the Waterline, which is the one that has a different lateral line than the other two?
I don't know. I'm going to make a confession here to you. Okay? I cannot reliably identify a Ciro mackerel. I have not seen enough of them to be able to tell 100% for sure. And I have a different method of telling Spanish and kingfish apart.
Okay, how do you tell Spanish and kingfish apart?
This method was told to me by a fisheries biologist with FWC because they said, you know, we looked at the lateral lines, and yeah, you can tell them apart by the lateral lines, and there's a couple of other different methods. And then we realized, and they said they were told this by a commercial fisherman, that the easiest way to tell them apart is to just lift the first dorsal fin and look at it. If it's black, it's a Spanish mackerel. If it's partly black, it's a Spanish mackerel. If it's gray or if it's silvery, it's a king. And it works on a 3-inch fish, and it works on a 10-inch fish, and it works on a 20-inch fish, and it works on a 30-inch fish. So look for a black first dorsal, black, opaque, you can't see through it, that's a Spanish. Gray, silvery, translucent, you can see through it, that's a king.
Okay, and the other thing is king mackerel, the lateral line has a sharp drop to it. The Ciro and the Spanish, the lateral line continues along sloping.
To throw things for a little bit of a loop, it's also possible to find hybrid fish. These fish are closely enough related that they can interbreed. Remember how they spawn. They just throw eggs and sperm out into the water, and whatever gets fertilized gets fertilized. So if they're spawning in an area near each other, it's possible to create hybrids of these two fish. And you can get some really kind of strange looking things where there's, you know, black opaque spines on the dorsal fin, and then the rest of it is mostly see-through with a couple of black spots on it. So weird stuff like that, err on the side of caution and call them Spanish.
All right. So anyway, we've been kind of going over, started off the show a little self-indulgent, but I think that people would like to know who we are, how we got into this, and what happens to all that. Because, you know, understanding each other is kind of critical. It's one of the reasons we try and go into different lures, different stuff. The more you understand a fish, the more you understand its habits, the more likely you are to catch them. And I consequently think that if you understand Josh and myself, how we got into this, and it was accidental on purpose, so it gives you a better insight as to who you're dealing with. And who you're dealing with is us. I like throwing shrimp for Spanish mackerel under a popping cork. I prefer the DOA popping cork to, say, Cajun Thunder. And all the other ones. I like it because the DOA has that heavy weight on it, allows me more casting distance. And when I'm popping for the mackerel with my shrimp, I'm pop, pop, let it sit for short pause, and then smack, smack, smack again, and a short pause. I'm doing a lot more noise than I do for trout, and it seems to work for me, where I can get more attention to my bait.
Well, it makes a lot of sense, because trout are usually not gathered up in large, dense schools and attacking bait fish at the surface, whereas Spanish mackerel do exactly that. It's one way that we find Spanish mackerel, is looking for that bait being bombarded at the surface by fish from underneath and by birds from on top. And it makes a lot of ruckus. If you're ever right there next to it, you can definitely hear it.
Now, I don't see any reason why you couldn't put a aught or a double aught squid spoon below popping cork and actually do very well with it. I think that something I've never tried, but I was just sitting here thinking, why couldn't you? I mean, the DOA popping corks, I use that oval one. You can get a lot of distance out of them because they added weight. And then that spoon would just kind of dance around underneath that popping cork. It might be a really good idea.
I don't see why it wouldn't work.
Now, another favorite thing of mine. Now, you can freeline shrimp to them. The one thing you cannot do is use a sinker.
Well, you can. You're just not going to catch very many.
Yeah, you're going to catch very, very few. As soon as you put the weight on the line, it goes through the school of mackerel so fast that you just don't have a chance. I mean, they're quick, but I don't know if they're that quick.
Yeah, and that can work to your advantage if you're trying to catch some of the fish that sometimes will hang out underneath Spanish mackerel. It's not unheard of for blackfin tuna to hang out underneath Spanish when they're far enough out in the Gulf of Mexico. And one of the tricks to try to catch one of those blackfins is to get a bait rapidly through that school of Spanish without it getting attacked and get it down to where they're hanging out.
Now, there's a lot of things that could work, and I think that's a really good bait to do exactly as you just said. It's a Clark squid spoon. It has a bullet weight on the front and a spinner blade.
What you've done is you've taken this and you've made it into like a trout spinner.
Right. Inline spinner.
But heavy and big and beefy.
And you can cast that out and let it fall below the school of mackerel, figuring you're going to get about 2 feet a second of fall out of that. So if you figure the mackerel are in the first 10 feet of water, you want to cast it, see the splash, count to five, keep your rod tip water level, and start reeling it in. And this is not a jerking one. This is a kind of a slow, steady retrieve. But if you count to five, you're going to put it about 10 feet below the surface.
Right. And the key thing to remember about this, if you're not familiar with fishing spinners, is that you're not going to be able to retrieve this thing as fast as you will a spoon. That spinning blade is going to prevent you from being able to reel it too fast. And if you do, you're just going to blow it out and ruin the action. You'll feel the thing thumping along as you reel it. And you want to feel that nice heavy thump coming back up your line. If it starts to get erratic, you're probably cranking too fast or way too slow.
Well, if you crank too fast, you'll raise it up in the water. That blade's going to create a lot of lift, and it's going to come very rapidly towards the surface. So it's turn, 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 turn type moderate speed retrieve on that.
Now, I've got another thing here that's very important when you're fishing for Spanish mackerel that we didn't discuss, but we really need to, because a lot of people I see going after Spanish mackerel for the first time want to use wire leader. And wire leader is fantastic for keeping fish from biting off your line, but it's not fantastic for getting fish to strike in the first place. In Spanish mackerel, they're feeding usually in areas that are bright and sunny. They already have really good eyesight, so having something that's less visible to trick them is probably a good idea, which is why I use 60-pound fluorocarbon when I'm fishing for Spanish mackerel. You do get cut off a little bit more than you would with wire, but you know what? You're going to get more strikes.
I don't think you're
going to
get cut off any more or any less. The problem with the Spanish mackerel is if you tie your leader on, you have a knot there. And once you start pulling that through the water, say fighting a fish, the knot, just the little ends, tag ends of the line, are going to create a little bit of cavitation, and the fish will hit that cavitation. They're going to see that little bit of bubble trail coming through the water and hit it, likely cutting your line. They cut braided line less easily, but they still will hit it. And I used to use, I still use a lot of these pre-made little steel leaders. But I use them in black, possibly red. I like the black first, red second. Silver is, in the days of monofilament, it's not as bad with braid. But when we had monofilament on, we were fishing with 6, 8, 10-pound mono. They would hit that swivel as it comes through the water because the eyes are creating a cavitation, little bubble trail. And then they see that shiny little object there, and boom, they'd hit it, cut you through your line every time. So I learned to use black. I think red is the best color in leader, but black create the least amount of break-offs, but I got more hits with the red.
Yeah. And, you know, what I've tried to do is minimize the amount of excess stuff that's on my line altogether. It's one of the reasons why I was really excited to learn the FG knot, which is not the easiest knot to tie, but because it doesn't create the kind of thing you were talking about. It doesn't create cavitation, and it doesn't create the, you know, even with...
Minimizes the cavitation.
Minimizes, sure.
Yeah.
Everything's going to create something. But even just the knots in monofilament, even if you don't have cavitation going on, you know, you're creating a little bundle of shiny plastic there. which is just a smaller version of your lure in a lot of cases. They'll absolutely hit that.
Little tiny squid. You know, I mean, a lot of things are translucent. They still get eaten.
And the swivels, too. You know, I found that they, even with black swivels, they go after swivels. When I rig a spoon and a ball bearing swivel together, I put the swivel right at the eye of the spoon so that it appears to be part of the bait rather than putting it at the end of the leader like a lot of people will want to do.
All right. The problem with putting, you want to use a snap swivel with a spoon. It's one of the few lures I highly, highly recommend putting a snap swivel on. Because the hole in the spoon on most spoons is punched out. And then the hole is not filed to make it smooth.
Right.
It's simply they stamp the spoon. They have a press that comes down, puts the spoon in whatever shape they want. They cut off the excess. And then the next step is to punch the hole for your line and punch your hole for the hook to go on. And there's always a sharp edge on the inside that cuts through almost any mono or fluorocarbon leader. And spoons being the way they are, I use a snap swivel to put my spoons on the line.
Yeah, if you don't have a split ring at where the eye ties on, if you're tying directly into the metal, that's absolutely almost necessary to do that.
Yeah, a lot of lures come with a split ring, like a little tiny keychain thing to tie your line to. Allows a lot more wiggle, eliminates the need for a loop knot, but the ones that don't, I quite often take that split ring off and just put my snap swivel right to the spoon. That is my loop knot, that's all of it, but it's a ball bearing swivel. A standard swivel won't swivel, so you gotta use the ball bearing.
And this is one of the few occasions where it's not a bad thing to have more hardware right there at the bait, because you're already using what basically amounts to a shiny piece of metal to attract this fish. A little bit more shiny metal isn't going to hurt anything. You know, it's not going to spook fish away like it can if you're using white bait or a live shrimp or something like that.
Okay, yeah, there's so much stuff to go on. We've been doing Spanish mackerel because it is going to be a big focus of everybody. Now, my recommendation with Spanish mackerel, what I do when I go out, and if I'm going out in the beginning of the day, make sure I have an ice chest on the boat. They will not, do not try and keep them alive in a live well. It probably won't work.
It definitely
and
won't work.
the big thing is if, here's the politically correct portion of the show. If you were here from a smaller country in Asia or Central America, they don't use the same icing and refrigeration techniques, and your body is used to these bacterias. If you were raised on white bread and rye bread here in the U.S., your stomach and intestines do not handle those bacteria as well. So if you want to eat a wonderful fish dinner and then pay for it for a day or two, go ahead, throw the fish on in a 5-gallon bucket. For me, I catch the fish, I put it on ice, I get home. With Spanish mackerel, if I have two people, I will keep three smaller, moderate-sized Spanish mackerel, two big ones, and I put them on the grill, I fillet them out, be very careful, a lot of bones in the belly. Fillet them out nice, get the meat, get all the bones out, rub my fingers across the fillets. I put butter and a little bit of lemon herb seasoning on it, face down on the grill. Once that's brown, I butter the other side, a little more lemon herb, flip it over, brown on both sides, done. Served with a little bit of coleslaw, some type of potato that you like, and a bread garlic thing. That's an awesome meal. The next day, not so much. This is something I'm going to do, catch them that morning and eat them that night. I make sure they're kept on ice all day and flay them and eat them in the same day. Awesome. What about you, Josh?
Well, I can tell the difference between a Spanish mackerel that hasn't been handled correctly and has been handled right. And to me, the difference is mostly in the texture of the fish. A fish that hasn't been handled right is mushy. I don't like mushy. So the way I kill a Spanish mackerel, I go a step beyond what you're doing. Ice in the cooler, dump in some salt water, make yourself a nice slush. Get that fish into the slush as soon as he comes aboard and make sure that he's down in it. And he hypothermiates to death, which means that most of the blood gets pulled into the guts.
Okay, well, guys, this is Fish and Frank, and that is Captain Josh Olive, my co-host for the show, and we are going to bid you guys a fond adieu. And we appreciate you listening here. And we'll catch you next week with more different stuff. We're not sure what different stuff, but a lot more different stuff. Because we know different stuff is going to happen.
Right.
And every week.
Many different things. And I've already been coming up with some ideas, some of which involve digging into your brain a little bit deeper, which is going to be weird, weird, weird.
Yeah, we don't really want to go there. So anyway, boys and girls and moms and dads and children of all ages, say goodbye, Josh.
Bye, Josh.
Bye, Frank. And wrote this big old Fred. He's too old to drive a rabbit, so he comes fishing with us instead. We got lawn chairs, a poker table, an ice cold keg of beer. We're loaded down with so much stuff, Mike can hardly steer. Hey, watch out for the stuff! When he oopers in a pontoon boat, fishing for Moby Dick. The wife, she thinks I'm working, and the boss, he thinks I'm sick. It's a perfect day for fishing, drinking beer, and telling lies. It's a little bit like heaven when you're fishing with the guys. Mooch is showing dirty shirt, the proper way to cast. His snags old no-neck behind the ear. Of course, nobody laughs. Dabber's grilling venison steaks. The flames are 3 feet high. His fishing hat is smoldering, but it keeps away the flies. Mungo's on his 15th beer. He's standing by the keg. He don't know Fred the Beagle is going on his leg.
And a boy Fred.
20 oopers in a pontoon boat, fishing for Moby Dick. The wife, she thinks I'm working, and the boss, he thinks I'm sick. It's a perfect day for fishing, drinking beer, and telling lies. It's a little bit like heaven when you're fishing with the guys. A Winnebago is bobbing by. It looks like Noah's Ark. It's full of terrorists from Ohio. They're fishing for freshwater shark. They say some fool forgot the plug. Their boat sank like a rock. So they launched a Winnebago. That beats fishing from the dock. So we all run up front to look, and the pontoon starts to sink. Everybody but Fred the Beagle ends up in the drink. 20 oopers in a pontoon boat, fishing for Moby Dick. The wife, she thinks I'm working, and the boss, he thinks I'm sick. It's a perfect day for fishing, drinking beer.